Hi, and good afternoon. Welcome to CSIS, and thank you all for coming to be with us this afternoon. I'm Steve Morrison, Director of the Global Health Policy Center here at CSIS. We're thrilled to have Ambassador Mark Dybul with us today for this very timely presentation, which I'll get to in a moment. Let me draw your attention to a few other things that are going to be happening here or over at Kaiser downtown in partnership with the Kaiser Family Foundation. November 20th, from noon to 2 p.m., we'll be gathering with a focus on Zimbabwe at Kaiser. We will be honoring Hopewell Chinono, the distinguished Zimbabwean journalist who's won two major international awards, and will present a segment of his documentary. We'll hear from Assistant Secretary Jindai Fraser, who will provide a keynote presentation on the U.S. view on the current situation and the progress in the unity or lack of progress in the unity accord from September. And there'll be a panel of experts that follow, all in this two-hour compressed time frame. Robert Rotberg, from Harvard, Jennifer Cook, the head of the Africa program here at CSIS, Leonard Doyle from The Independent, and Shannon Hayter, head of the District of Columbia's HIV-AIDS program and formerly head of the CDC program in Zimbabwe. So please come to that. It's November 20th. A couple of other events that are happening. Shannon Hayter, we're actually going to get two opportunities to engage with her on December 2nd from 1 to 3 p.m. here at CSIS. We're going to take a look at what's happening here domestically in the United States with respect to HIV/AIDS control, care, and treatment here in the District of Columbia. And Shannon Hayter will be coming and presenting an update on the progress that's been made here in the District of Columbia. And I would urge you all to come to that. And we're looking to have either the city administrator or the mayor come and do the introductions on that. December 5th, 1 to 3 p.m., we'll be doing a program together with PATH on malaria control in Zambia. Very interesting presentation. And then December 12th at Kaiser, 2 to 3:30, Secretary Leavitt will reflect on his experiences as secretary with respect to health diplomacy, the kind of work and experiences that he's had operating outside of our borders and what that says in terms of the evolving role of the secretary at HHS and the kind of agenda that's come forward. Now, let me turn to today. Here at CSIS, we've been involved a lot on HIV/AIDS programs, on the task force on HIV/AIDS. We had a commission on smart power that we felt was quite successful that made very clear that looking forward into the next administration, that the kind of investments that have been made in global health in this era, in the last several years during the Bush administration, had resulted in extensive achievements, had sustained a significant amount of goodwill in key places in the world, predominantly in Africa, but extending well beyond that, and that as part of any broad strategy looking forward in the next administration of restoring America's place in the world, that these investments were going to be critical. They were going to be important. They were a zone of substantial achievement and of bipartisan cooperation, of sustained commitment by the United States, ones that we should be very proud of and be very sensitive in trying to preserve those gains. We're now in the midst of two historic transitions, one which, you know, the end of the Bush era and the change to presidency under President-elect Barack Obama. The second, of course, the transition into an uncertain and unprecedented global financial crisis. And some of and this all has generated substantial questions around how do we navigate the uncertainties around the global financial crisis, and how do we make the transition from one political era to another political era. And a political era that is bringing lots of hope and enthusiasm as we move into the Obama administration, and one that when we look back on the Bush era achievements is one that people are quite rightly very proud about what has been put in place on global health. we turned to Mark, to Ambassador Dybul, because for a couple of reasons. One, he's been a remarkable leader and a very thoughtful thinker on these issues. We believe that there's certain risks today. There's risks of not defending the achievements. There's risks of reacting too quickly and rashly in the short term, not keeping a view of the long-term goals in sight, and perhaps in the midst of these uncertainties and these contractions that we're going to go through, trying to be pragmatic and flexible and consolidating our priorities and not losing sight of the long term and what's at play. And my own feeling, we heard some of this, some very good reflections on what this all means when Peter Piot was here recently. The community of leadership on global health has been understandably reticent, I think, and cautious in coming forward and talking about what this all means as we enter these two momentous transitions. It's understandable that people are uncertain as to how things will cut, but I think it's very important that we do begin to have a dialogue, an active dialogue. And it was with that in mind, we turned to Mark and asked him to reflect on these changes and what lies ahead, and to reflect on what kind of principles and strategy would make sense as we move into this era, because I think we need to get into the atmosphere good thinking from folks who work these issues and who are able to lead in this period. And so we're very grateful, Mark, to you for coming and being with us today. I also want to register gratitude to my colleagues here at CSIS, to Kate Hoffler, Karen Meacham, Suzanne Brundage, Heather Texera, Eric Little for helping put this event together, and to Kaiser Family Foundation for their partnership in webcasting this and posting the transcript from this event. I know Alicia Carbaugh is here today. I certainly hope Jen Cates has been able to join us also today. They're very close partners, and we value that very much. So welcome, Mark, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Yikes. Thank you, Steve, and thanks to CSIS and Kaiser, not only for today, but I think everyone knows Steve's engagement in HIV/AIDS and development spans a long time, including really being one of the first bipartisan efforts to push the agenda, and it's been a wonderful privilege to work with you personally and through CSIS and also with the Kaiser Family Foundation. As Steve pointed out, this is a historic time on many levels, and it's an exciting time. The title of the talk, I think, is an important one. I think that one of the most important things to note is we're in great hands at the moment, particularly from an HIV perspective, but I think from a broader development perspective. President-elect Obama was a co-sponsor of PEPFAR reauthorization, one of the people who signed on to the bill. Vice President-elect Biden, who I always can think of as Chairman Biden, I think, because of his extraordinary role in development for 35 years, pushing the agendas that so many of us in this room care about. So from the executive branch, we have two strongly dedicated leaders who believe in the issues that most of the people in this room care about. And beyond the administration, in the Congress, we have four committees, authorization and appropriations, in a bipartisan way from the chairman, chairpersons and ranking members, and importantly, the staff. I mean, we are a pretty blessed group. We have some of the most dedicated, talented people roaming around Congress as members and staff. So, and to be honest, the community here, and I think reauthorization showed that, the ability of this community to come together to push for things that matter and do it in a way where we could recognize agreement, recognize disagreement, and then push towards a common approach that led to a remarkably historic success. So I'm not going to presume to give advice to this group of people who we couldn't be in better hands. So while there may be disagreements from time to time, I have no doubt that the people who will be responsible for moving things forward in the administration and Congress will do the best they can with the information that's available. And I think one of the things we have to do as a community is give them an awful lot of space to do that and trust that they will move these issues forward in the best possible way. But as Steve said, it's going to be a difficult time for a number of issues. And so rather than offering advice, I'd more provide some reflections, which Steve kind of said I would do based on the experience I've had for the last 7 years, beginning with the Mother and Child Initiative and then PEPFAR, both in terms of the planning process but also implementation. And I think one of the most important things we can do right now is not be overly concerned about the challenges and focus on the opportunities and in some ways the responsibilities. A very important person in the new administration, the new chief of staff, said, you know, the first principle is to always take advantage of a crisis. And we have that opportunity. And we actually have, I think, that responsibility more than opportunity, responsibility. A couple of weeks ago, many of you participated in a White House summit on a new era of development. I think it wound up being more of a new era than we planned because when the summit was scheduled, the events of the last couple of months hadn't yet occurred. And as Steve said, there's a new era in many ways, a new era in terms of resource commitment over the last 8 years, a strong era of bipartisanship, innovative approaches, a lot to learn from, a lot of lessons learned, but also a new era of challenges now. And I think great opportunity. We were told after that summit that the United States and President Bush was the first and still the only global leader to say we can't back away from commitments on development, that cannot be a part of what we do. And, you know, maybe we can talk about a little bit is reiterate some of those principles of why, but also think about how you could put pieces together as people try to go forward. You know, everyone's aware that over the last 8 years, with strong bipartisan support, regardless of who was in the majority, we have had the single greatest growth in development since the Marshall Plan. And I think it's worthwhile reflecting for a moment as we look to the future on some of the components of the Marshall Plan. There's a lot of differences, but what were the things that kind of led to and pushed for the Marshall Plan? Because I think it's reflective of where we've been the last 8 years. And there were two basic components: moral responsibility, but secondly, enlightened self-interest. And I think it's probably on that second piece that we need to reflect a little bit more and promote things a little bit more. On the area of moral responsibility, we probably have kind of reached our limit of support based on moral responsibility and development. It's strong. Everyone in this room feels it. The people who are assuming the current executive branch, those who are assuming the executive branch, members of Congress, that is there. And so I think we can almost take that as a given at this point. President Bush always says, to whom much is given, much is required. I think Secretary Rice a few weeks ago said, I think, a remarkable sentence that reneging on our commitments to the world's poor cannot be an austerity measure. I think that's a great summary of our moral responsibility in this new era and in these challenges. But that's not the only reason to do development. It wasn't the case for the Marshall Plan, and it's not the case today. Enlightened self-interest has a great deal to do with development. And to be honest, maybe if we got past the terms assistance and aid, we might see that. These are not just charity programs. Charity programs tend to be the first thing to go in economic crises. Things that are good for you tend not to be the first things that go in economic crises. And so we ought to think about why these programs are good for us. And this is hardly innovative thought here. I mean, people have been talking about this for many years, but maybe to put a fine point on some of it, more than in 1947, when the Marshall Plan was put together, if the last couple of months have taught us anything, it's that we live in a global community. We live in an economically tied and politically connected global community in ways we have never before. So the last thing to do in a period of global economic and political difficulty is to turn inward. The thing we need to do most is turn outward, because the political and economic stability of the world is now more than ever directly related to our political and economic security. Markets of the future are our markets. Stability, we see over and over again around the world, directly contributes to where we dedicate our treasure and our time and to how we can grow. So this is not charity work. It's humanitarianly driven, but it is also very much in our political and economic security to focus on development. As a part of that, I think there are two components that have been particularly pronounced in the last couple of years and things to learn from that we have seen over and over again. Steve has mentioned some of these. So part of enlightened self-interest is global and economic security for us. But part of it, too, is how we are viewed in the world. And that is true in the international community as well as in the countries in which we're privileged to serve. I think as we travel around from international meeting to international meeting, I just got back from a Global Fund board meeting, and I'm going to talk about that actually at the very end, the perception of Americans and who we are and our role in the world has changed as a result of our involvement in international development. And that's a good thing. That's a very good thing. But perhaps more important is how we are perceived in the countries in which we serve. Steve referred to this. You know, 8 of 10 of the countries with the highest approval ratings of the United States, and as Jendai Fraser often points out, some of them with higher approval ratings than Americans have of the United States, are in Africa. That's not an accident, I don't think. And those of us who have been privileged to travel, which is many in this room, from national governments, from presidents of countries, to the most remote village, people talk about the results and the lifting up of them as people and communities that have radically changed how they view us. And I think a key part of that is something we're going to talk about in a little bit, is that we have initiated together, not just this administration, but working closely with Congress, what the New York Times called a philosophical revolution, an actual proactive belief and trust in people on the ground to do the work on a national level. And that's changed how people look at us, that approach of we believe in you and trust in you, that we're not coming to help poor and educated people, that this is not charity, this is development. This is an investment in our future, and it's an investment in your future together. And that public diplomacy aspect is very much in our self-interest as political and economic situations in the world continue to coalesce and engage us beyond our own borders. The other piece of enlightened self-interest, the third piece, which I don't think we spend as much time focusing on, but President Bush has talked about, and I think is incredibly important, is how this work is important to our national character, to who we are as a people, to reinvigorating our core beliefs and principles, our founding core beliefs and principles, a hope for life, liberty, and opportunity for all people. When we do this work globally, we enhance our own national character. We reinvigorate our founding principles. I was just at a World Economic Forum meeting with 700 people thinking and brainstorming, as they said, and all these councils. And there was a lot of discussion about how systems have failed us, how the global financial and political systems have failed us, how we need to change them. And while there's no question we need global systems to be put in place, and we need them to work well, there was no discussion of the fact that the systems were created by and are operated by human beings. There was not much recognition about the importance of human development and the advancement of us as individuals who believe in service and serve as in part of our actions. If we corrected the human behavior, the human development pieces, the bigger pieces would fall into place. The systems would work because at every point in a system, someone makes a decision or fails to make a decision. And collectively, that leads to systems problems. And part of development is part of our own national character, where we are building a service generation effectively that believes in moral responsibility and humility and compassion and wisdom. And if we do that for our own national character, that is good for us as well. And that's a piece of self-interest I don't know that we've reflected enough on, but might be a very important thing as we move forward. I don't know that alone is going to lead to increased appropriations. I doubt it. But it is something to reflect on, I think, and think about. kind of moving beyond the justification for why we have development. And we do need, and I've spoken with some heads of development from other countries, really to think reflectively on how we talk about development. Because words matter and how we talk about it matters. And if we position it in a different way, if we talk more about our enlightened self-interest and why this matters to us on multiple levels, I think we have an extraordinary opportunity. It's also the reality. We should talk about things as they are, not the way they used to be. And the way things are right now are, in fact, both moral responsibility and enlightened self-interest, now more than ever, certainly more than 1947. But we also have developed as a global community principles, guiding principles for effective development. And one of the most important things is not just to say why we should have development and to use development, but how you're going to have effective development. Because if you can demonstrate effectiveness, then support almost always follows to the degree it's possible. And those principles began with the Monterey Consensus, were reiterated in the Paris Declaration, and now the Accra Accord. And they were the basis for the sessions at the White House Summit. The White House Summit wasn't based around initiatives. It wasn't to say, look what PEPFAR's done, or MCC's done, or PMI's done. It was around those principles. And the first principle that the day opened with was country ownership, because that's at the heart of all of this. And that's at the heart of a shift in how we approach development and why people have changed their perceptions on the ground of the American people, because it begins with the trust and faith in individuals to do the work. It begins with doing away with donors and recipients and developing partnership. And when you reach out, and just like with a child, when you reach out and trust them, as people reach out and trust us, and we reach out and trust them. And as just in a friendship or any other relationship, when it begins in trust and believing in each other, you actually can go a heck of a lot further. And country ownership is at the heart of effective development. Country ownership, too, and this is a shift in the last several years in development, is not government to government, it's people to people. And that means all sectors. And that means government, non-governmental, faith, community-based organization, and the private sector. And that's the only way we're going to develop. And one of the things we're emphasizing in the next phase of PEPFAR, and that was emphasized in reauthorization, is partnership compacts to really emphasize that. And the other aspect of country ownership is countries don't look at their countries as an AIDS problem and a maternal health problem and a child survival and health problem and a food problem. They look at it as problems. A big problem that they need to work on. And what we're hoping for in these partnership compacts is that we do the same, that in our development structures we are integrated enough to support the national strategy. So in these compacts, we're asking people not just to look at HIV/AIDS, but to their big picture, where they want to be in 5 years in development. Now, we can't do everything, but then the second question is, how does HIV contribute to that? How do PEPFAR resources contribute to their overall picture for development? And how do other pieces fit in? We're encouraging people to use Global Fund CCMs as a mechanism for compacts, as a principal vehicle for multi-sectoral approach. We have an opportunity to think big and large as we move towards country ownership to allow them to drive the agenda as we contribute and support. And that also will contribute to building countries in a much stronger and more significant way to contribute to some of those enlightened self-interest components we've talked about. The second basic guiding principle is a results base. And this is something we have learned over the last 8 years, that results matter, that transparency in reporting matters, that ability to identify where money is going, what it is going for, who is using it, and what you're getting for it matters, that cost efficiency matters. And if you focus on results, then you have an opportunity to advocate in a far more potent way. In the early days of PEPFAR, there were actually senior development people who told me that we had to stop giving Congress so much information because they were just going to ask for more. Congress gets to decide where the money goes. If you don't give Congress information, you have no chance to succeed. And what does that say about transparency and development if we can't even within our own government feel comfortable sharing information? The sharing of information gives you the opportunity to learn and change and improve. And so basing things in results and reporting and information is an essential component of effective development. It also, and this has been proven in a crystal clear way in the last 8 years. If you can say what your goals are, show how you're dedicating money towards them, and achieve those results, and be open and transparent about how you share that, and be open to change based on the information, you have opportunity to expand. And I think reauthorization of PEPFAR was a perfect demonstration of that, but it's hardly the only one. The Global Fund is another great example. But we do have challenges and financial challenges. So for the future, one of our opportunities is to increase our efficiency as we report on what we do and as we have our results base. And we are not efficient in our development at the moment. I keep saying publicly, and so far Henrietta hasn't hit me, that we could probably be doing 20 to 40% more with the money we have today if we were more efficient and more coordinated in how we do it, which means we could save more lives today with the money that we have. And we have an opportunity in a financial crisis to use information and reporting and a results base to push for an integrated U.S. government approach across development, which will support country ownership in a more efficient way that will save more lives and lift up more lives with the money that we have today. It's an extraordinary opportunity. And more than that, it's a responsibility. What possible justification is there for divisions and bureaucratic turf when lives are at stake? If you ask someone in a village if they care whose logo is on the clinic they go to, or what funding stream came in, or who gets to oversee which account, or if you ask them would they rather have their child cared for and their nutritional support provided, I think we know what their answer would be. Our answer should be the same, and we should be pushing for that type of system in an integrated, efficient way. And this is an opportunity. A financial crisis is an opportunity to push that. And the way to do it is by beginning with results and beginning with reporting and accountability so you can see where the opportunities are and then connect the dots of development in an effective way. And this is something President Bush called on us to do a year and a half ago, May of 2007, when he called for reauthorization of PEPFAR. He called for us to do two things, partnership compacts and connect the dots of development. And now we have an even greater opportunity to do that. The third aspect of these principles from the Monterey Consensus, the Paris Declaration, now across good governance. Now, we tend to think about good governance in other countries, which, of course, is important. There needs to be good governance in all sectors, government, non-governmental, and down to the village level. But we also need good governance at home. And that gets back to an interagency integrated approach that breaks down bureaucratic walls so that we have a cost-efficient, demonstrable, results-based approach that leads to efficiency and it leads to maximal number of lives saved and lifted up for the resources we have available. So when we talk about good governance, we should be looking inward as well as outward, be looking at our own systems as well as the systems of others, and this is an opportunity to do that. This is an extraordinary opportunity to look at that, to see how we can better operate in our own governance structures, in our own development approaches for a more effective future and a more hopeful future. I just came from not only the World Economic Forum, but the Global Fund board meeting. And I have to say it was an extraordinary board meeting and really demonstrated the maturity of that institution and organization and really demonstrated it as a hope for our future as we look towards development. We've always said that in many ways our bilateral program is an intermediary step, that for the long term those principles of Monterey and Paris and Accra are very much embodied in the founding principles of the Global Fund. We'll take some time to develop it fully, but over time it is a great hope. It's also a great hope for the American taxpayer because the rest of the world is involved as well as us. At this board meeting, we came up against what some would call a financial crisis. We came up against more demand than we had resources for. But rather than having a board devolve and pitch battles against different constituencies, because the board's made up of constituencies from implementers and constituencies from implementing partners, the board came together in a cohesive whole, said, what is the problem? How do we balance advocacy and fiduciary responsibility, and came up with a solution that maintains the long-term viability of the Global Fund? it really was an extraordinary moment and an demonstration of extraordinary maturity and evolution in the fund, the board of the fund. We have a similar opportunity right now in the U.S. government. We have a similar opportunity to see if we're going to work together, to face the challenges together, to have a long-term view that balances advocacy and fiduciary responsibility, and that maximizes what we do. If we do all this, if we really focus on moral responsibility and enlightened self-interest, if we focus on those principles of country ownership and good governance and results-based and economic development that will lead to promoting all of that. And given who our incoming leadership is, which comes from a very similar place on development than our existing leadership, we have extraordinary opportunity. We have extraordinary opportunity to keep pushing this agenda, to keep lifting up and saving lives, to constantly learn from and improve. We have the opportunity to continue to change the world. And more than that, we have the responsibility. Because if we don't do that, Congress should not push forward to fund what we do. If we do not take the responsibility to do better at what we do, to learn from what we do, to use these principles to improve development, we cannot advocate in an effective way, and nor should we be successful, because we have to do these things. So I view this time, this new era in development, with an extraordinary excitement and optimism, because we have an opportunity to radically and significantly improve what we're doing and build off of the extraordinary success of the last 8 years, and to learn from what has been done the last 8 years, both from multilateral organizations and our bilateral program, for a brighter future. So we have a lot of challenges. The incoming administration, Congress, will have a lot of balancing to do. But if we act balancing the many pieces that are out there, we have extraordinary opportunity as well. So that may be less specific than people wanted. But as I said, I think we have we have a group coming in whom we can have extraordinary confidence and faith and trust, both in the executive and congressional and in the community. So the opportunities are there, and the hope is extraordinary. So I look forward to the next couple of years and to a very bright future for development. So I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mark. That's a very positive vision, and it's one that really, Mark, you've put a great emphasis on continuity and a great emphasis on managing a smooth or seamless sort of transition period with an orientation towards the positive opportunities that are very much in front of us. And it's interesting the degree which our debate has shifted to the broader developmental context and trying to get greater integration and efficiencies and unity of effort to show that this is working. We are vulnerable. I mean, we do have a domestic opinion environment that is very anxious, that is inward-looking, as shouldn't be surprising, where the storyline around the achievements under PEPFAR and PMI and other programs, the storyline has not registered among many of our voters and many of our citizens, and more needs to be done there. And there's a certain anxiety, and the opinion climate around foreign assistance, development investments, it remains weak, or it is weakening, as it's been documented. And we have a very, very crowded transitional agenda that involves putting a scale of resources against very uncertain projects in terms of the financial bailout, the fiscal stimulus, the continuation of two wars, on a scale that it's very hard for us to digest the magnitude of some of those. So those are some of the sort of big picture challenges that are out there, I think, as we move forward. I think how we shape the thematics becomes very important, that we are committed to engaging the world, committed to engaging on a better level, committed to preserving and carrying forward the achievements that we know have been working now, and doing it in this broad context of development. I would like to invite our friends here to weigh in with brief comments. Please identify yourselves. We have microphones. There are two people here, and there's one back here. We're going to bundle folks together. So we'll start with the two folks right here.
Good afternoon. Thank you. T.I.G. Salam, Congressional Research Service. Ambassador Dybul, I have two questions for you. The first is that I'm happy to hear that as the head of Global AIDS that you're advocating for an integrated approach to global health. There is some concern among some people that support for HIV/AIDS is crowding out other health activities, so I'm glad to hear that you support that. In light of that, there are some who are calling for maybe a cabinet-level global health office. What is your opinion on that to help to with this coordinated approach that you've mentioned? Also, Congress might be taking up foreign aid reform soon. And what role do you think global health should have in that, if any?
Thank you. Hold for a second. Yes, right next to you.
Thank you. My name is Kate Schechter. I'm from the American International Health Alliance. And I have a question about, I thought that your description of the board meeting of the Global Fund was fascinating. I'm wondering, I realize you can't give us all the details, but you said that there was this very mature response to a difficult situation, which, as you said, we're going to be facing in all aspects of development. And I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit more detail about how that was resolved within the board.
Thank you. In the back.
I'm Matt Kavanaugh from Results. Thanks very much for the presentation. I guess a couple questions specifically on the Global Fund. I mean, it seems like one of the biggest changes that we'll actually see with the incoming president is that we've got a current administration that's been really pretty hostile in terms of multilateralism for pushing for actually decreases each year in the contribution of the U.S. to the Global Fund. And so one of the pieces, obviously, that Mr. Obama has put front and center has been support for the Global Fund. Kind of within that context, it seems, I guess I have a slightly less rosy picture of the board meeting. I think you're right in terms of having seen the board coalesce. But we've still got a place where we're $700 million short of what we need just to kind of approve the current proposals. And it seems like we've kind of just kicked the can down the road 6 months. I wonder what your thoughts are on how do we dig ourselves out of this ditch and make sure that we can actually get us to an $8 billion number in the next year. How can the kind of bilaterals help us get there? What's going to be your role and others' role to kind of really make sure that we do make that transition to a sustainable fund?
Thank you. There's a hand right in front of you. And then what we'll do is come back to Mark, and then we'll do a second round. So be patient, please. Yes.
My name is Netta Simnani from Congressional Quarterly. Quickly, adding on to the first question about the cabinet-level position, whether a global health cabinet department head would be appropriate or a larger foreign aid department.
Can you say that once again, please?
A broader foreign aid department at a cabinet level would be more appropriate. And then you had mentioned earlier in your speech about development as kind of a reflection of the American national character. And I suppose I have a rather philosophical question about that. America actually has one of the lowest in terms of the amount of money our government gives towards foreign aid. And I wonder if it is such a crucial part of our national character, how is that reflected in terms of our appropriations?
Thank you.
Mark, why don't we come back to you on those?
Let me begin with the Congressional Research Service notion that you're delighted that we support integrated programs, which is great, but we have always supported integrated programs from the beginning. The incremental cost of, for example, adding there's literally an infrastructure of hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers right now going out to homes once a week. The incremental cost of adding maternal health onto that, child health, vaccination, neglected tropical diseases, tuberculosis, building education links with orphans and vulnerable children from HIV, gender enhancement, the opportunities are limitless. There's never been resistance from our office to doing that. The problem is to be honest, bureaucratic walls don't fit those things all that easily. And what happens is you wind up not building incrementally on, but building whole new systems for different things. And we've seen this over and over and over again. And there's a lot of room for improvement there, But there's never been any resistance to doing it on our end. We have wanted to do it. We have advocated for doing it. It's not also that easy. You know, people are in different regions and countries and different populations are impacted. But we have an opportunity now to make this happen in a more effective and efficient way. Now, whether or not, as two people, both yourself and another, asked about a cabinet-level position, I do have personal opinions on that, and once I'm no longer in government, I'd be happy to express those personal opinions. But there's more than one way to do this. And to be honest, I think there's too much focus on things like that, you know, big picture solutions, which aren't going to fix any of the problems per se, rather than saying, how do we ensure and what are the mechanisms to ensure integrated programs across bureaucratic lines? And you don't need necessarily a cabinet-level position to do it. You don't necessarily need any additional organizational structures. What you need is actually far more at the working level, at the not-so-sexy stuff that breaks down bureaucratic walls. It's much easier to talk about big-picture organizational stuff. But big-picture organizational stuff in the life cycle of a 4 or 8-year administration is highly unlikely to change what's actually going on at a lower level, which is where all the work's done. And the only caution I would give is focusing too much on that and thinking that's going to solve the problem is going to be a problem because it's not going to. I think these are important conversations. As I said, you know, I think we can have tremendous trust and we should give an awful lot of latitude to the incoming administration and Congress to try to work these things out. Give opinions, but trust them to make the final decisions on these, given the competing pieces, but try to focus more on actually making sure things change than the high-level organizational stuff. On the Global Fund, there are a couple of points on that. First of all, Matt, you know, I understand your comment, but I have to push back awfully strong on hostility toward the Global Fund. There has been no more supportive group of people towards the Global Fund than this administration and the people we work with. We are at every level, at the administrative level, at the secretariat level, and if you ask the secretariat, I think they would tell you that. We are highly supportive of the Global Fund. President Bush gave the first gift, the first second gift. We're by far the largest contributor. Yes, the amount the administration asked for is less than the Congress often gives and less than previous year's contributions, but larger than the previous year's request, which is a bureaucratic thing. But it is a demonstration from the administration's perspective of confidence in and growing financial support. The issue around the fund has always been at what pace and when. We have always, and you know, I've said many times publicly, and I've gotten a lot of calls, not so supportive from some people afterwards, that for the long term, the Global Fund is really an ideal mechanism. But you don't start from zero to get all the way. And to some degree, the capacity building that's been done over the last couple of years, I think, will make the Global Fund even stronger in the future. So the disagreement has never been about the importance of the Global Fund or hostility towards the fund. The issue has always been, in a single fiscal year, resources for bilateral and multilateral programs. And I think you can have that discussion without hostility and with just exchanging views and then coming to a decision, which is what's happened over the last couple of years. We have begun to try to look at how you could systematically transition from bilateral to multilateral programs. And I think there are intelligent ways to do that. It's not easy, and it's going to be closely working with Congress and appropriators. So as you're moving programs, you're also moving resources, and it's going to be a very difficult thing. But it's very doable, and I think for a long-term approach, that's where we need to go. Relative to the board meeting and the question on more detail on that, It really was remarkable. There were some people, not surprisingly, because advocates, that's their job. They're advocates, so they need to keep pushing for advocacy. But from the implementing countries and the people actually implementing programs and the international partners who are, for the most part, resourcing, from the beginning, the conversation was, we don't have the money today to fund all of this. And if you look to 2011, we have this huge shortfall. And what we were looking at was really not dissimilar from a balloon loan or a no-interest loan. That, yeah, you would have the money today to put it out, but you are leaving a huge commitment that you're not sure you will be able to meet in 2011, and that threatens the long-term viability from a fiduciary responsibility standpoint. So what do we do to be as aggressive as possible as we can today while having fiduciary responsibility? And if resources become available, more resources are available, in 2 years you can grow it. The issue is actually not $700 million today. That money is actually there in pledges. As long as people meet their commitments to current pledges, there are resources to fund that round at around $2.75 billion or up to $3 billion. So it's not a short-term issue on that extra money because that's in pledges as long as people meet their pledges. It really is a 2011 issue. And it's possible, and that led to issues around RCC and phase two, which is way too much detail to get into for here. But there's flexibility in 2011 if there's money to reconsider or to reconsider tomorrow or to do new rounds if new money becomes available. But it was an extraordinary sense of balancing advocacy and fiduciary responsibility, recognizing that the fund is an important institution, has to survive for the long term. And the parallel to financial crises in the banking institutions, I think, actually is a very good one. On the question on reflecting our values and tradition, you're referring to official development assistance. And I actually think this is a critical point, because for the rest of the world, official ODA is how you do development and how you do support, and it's principally government to government. Our ODA is 1 to 9 of what this country provides as a country, as a people, whether it's through remittances or through private sector contributions or for individual contributions to our non-governmental organizations that do extraordinary work. We are the only country with that type of ratio. I didn't say something that.
We have staff in the back who sort of turn that on periodically. Yeah. Like the point you made.
So, you know, even when you add those other things in, we're still not at the same overall percents. But if you look at total dollars rather than percents, I mean, some of the institutions have come up with real tricks, like putting little hash marks you can barely see when they put total dollars, because if you actually put the total dollar bar for the United States and our contributions just from ODA compared to total dollars for others, it would run onto several pages, whereas everyone else would be a little quarter of a page. And then it gets to how do you effectively utilize all that money in a period of time with the institutions and structures. Now, we've seen over the last couple of years that you can rapidly scale up and can do things no one thought was possible. It's important to remember 5 years ago, virtually no one thought the emergency plan could succeed in goals that we'd set. And we're going to do it. And that's the same with, you know, scale up of resources for development. There is the opportunity to do that if you do it in a well-planned increase over time approach. But I do think it's important when we talk about development support, we not just talk about ODA. I think that's a trap that is a mistake because we have to look at the bigger picture. And really, that philosophical shift from government to people is reflected in our overall approach to ODA. And there you really do see the core values of the American people, that people out of their pocket, not just out of their tax dollars, contribute to the uplifting of others in other countries. So you see this very much in our approach to development. Always room for improvement, but.
Okay, let's move Nandini and then Paul.
Thanks, Steve, for organizing this session, and thanks, Ambassador Dybul, as always, for sharing your thoughts. I really appreciated the comment about increasing efficiency and effectiveness of the financing from PEPFAR, and I suppose that one of the ways moving forward would be the transitioning from bilateral to multilateral assistance. The question I had was that despite that, I think, trend and the way in which the U.S. perhaps would want to see the money go towards multilateral assistance, there is a lot of conversation in the field and here about how PEPFAR and Global Fund need each other and how they've been succeeded because of the inputs that the two of them have been able to provide along with other partners in the field. So I just wondered whether you could actually share with us as you step off, I wouldn't say down, to tell us what components of PEPFAR actually would be best retained as a bilateral mechanism because a multilateral cannot actually perhaps do those. So that would really be interesting. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Katie Reek from HealthGap. My question is about, as you know, Senator Obama came out and said that he was going to support overturning the federal ban on funding for syringe exchange domestically. Is this something that you can, dealing with PEPFAR, can you revise guidelines to allow programs to implement and then support those programs for syringe exchange, especially since the global money isn't barred by U.S. law to go to syringe exchange programs, and it's extremely effective, as you emphasized several times.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am, right here. And then behind you.
Hi, sorry.
Let's begin with you, please.
Did I lose my cue?
Oh, I thought you were passing it off.
It was
very rapidly.
It was gratifying, Ambassador Dybul, to see the guidance that you guys, the pretty solid guidance that OGAC put out about the 140,000 health workers after the bill was signed into law. There wasn't anything in there. It was gratifying, especially since it was one of the things you guys fought us on for a while. But it explicitly didn't mention anything about retention, and it didn't mention anything. The guidance didn't mention anything about the 2.3 doctors, nurses, and midwives per 1,000 country residents, which is also part of the law. Do we think that we will be able to update the guidance? What is the plan for 2.3 health workers per 1,000 and around retention? Thank you very much.
Right here.
Thank you very much, Stella Goings, AID. Ambassador Dybul, you've had a wonderful opportunity over the last several years to experiment and to guide some very innovative new approaches to how development actually works. And I wonder if you could give us some more insight into the role you see possibly for the private sector. Where do they fit, and what kind of development architecture might we be looking at with the next administration and in years to come?
Right behind you.
Thank you for your reflections, Mark. Rick Burzon with AMFAR. And I just want to follow up on a question with respect to efficiency and how to improve efficiency and essentially get a bigger bang for our buck. And as a former USAID person and with a number of people in the room that have been very much involved with public health evaluations, including Shannon Hader, who ran the committee for a couple of years, I'd like to know if PEPFAR will continue to intensify this kind of work to evaluate exactly what works and what doesn't work, specifically in the area of prevention, which is so desperately needed, so that we can really do as good a job as we can to target the resources that we have, which are in danger of being diminished because of the global crisis that we're in. Thank you.
I'll just go in order because they're not as related to some of as the last group. Nandini, I think you're absolutely right. There's no question that there's been a synergy, and that's actually why it's never been a hostility towards the fund. It's always been a what is the right mix for this year, because there's a clear recognition on the ground that both are needed. There was a clear recognition when the fund was created. The fund was created as a financing institution, not as a technical provider. And that's real the rare. And this is true not only of the Global Fund, but also of countries that have resources, like South Africa. We don't need to be doing in 10 years, or I hope sooner than that, a lot of programming in South Africa. They have the resources. But what will always be needed is technical support. And so as you're scaling down your programmatic effort from a bilateral program, you would, in our view, and, you know, this, you know, the new administration and Congress will have to work through this as well. but would always preserve a technical support mechanism. And that's what the countries tell us that they want for the long term, too, whether it's in our own bilateral relationship or through the Global Fund. And that's where we would see the transition time. But that's principally why we see a phase-in and a shift. As you transition program over, you maintain a technical support capacity, which also allows us to reduce our in-country staff considerably and allow the local people to do it, which is something else I think is far more politically difficult and will be a big challenge is how, because one of the most efficient things to do is to turn things over from international partners to local organizations. That cost savings is huge, huge. But it's not so easy. And this is where a lot of difficulty will come, but necessity. That is one of the biggest areas for efficiency for the future and one where we believe we need to promote. We have put into all grants and our big track ones, they have 3 years to turn over what they're doing principally to local organizations, or they're not eligible to apply again for funding for the same activity. We have put into all of our grants through the agency's language, and actually someone just disregarded this a couple years ago, but then we forced it back in, that there had to be benchmarks and grants to turn over what you're doing to a local organization, government, non-government, whoever, a local organization. That's a key part of country ownership and ultimate success, but also of efficiency. But it's also very difficult, and it's going to require people in this room to be committed to that principle to achieve it. It's not that easy to do. But that's where vision comes in, because there'll always be someone else who needs some support for a while. And that's what development is, right? We don't want to be here in 25 years doing the same thing in the same country. We're supposed to be promoting development and country ownership. So we all need to get behind that principle and accept the consequences for our own organizations of that. And that's where a lot of the efficiency is going to come in. But then we'll always have the technical support. On the syringe exchange, as you quite rightly point out, there has never been an international, there's never been a global language on this in legislative action. It's domestic, which was applied in the Clinton administration and then in this administration globally. The reauthorization is silent on it. So the new administration and the new Congress has the opportunity to take whatever route they would like to take in this. The flexibility is there to do what they believe they would like to do. On healthcare workers, the law says work towards 2.3. It does not say achieve. And we will not achieve that in a five-year period under any circumstances. This is where I think our multilateral partners come into play. President Bush and Prime Minister Blair put forward before the G8 a healthcare worker initiative, as you know, to try to get us in 4 countries from an average of about 1 in 1,000 healthcare worker to 1.7 over a five-year period, and we're working towards the 2.3. And the principal provider of resources for that is PEPFAR, because we have the largest resources, so we'll do our piece for that. There aren't enough resources and other pieces of the government to contribute to that. We've called on the rest of the G8 to do the same thing, but we haven't gotten a whole lot of commitment to that at the moment. But it's going to take more than us to do it, but we're trying to do our part to push the agenda. We also need a lot of information. We don't know the right ratio of healthcare worker to nurse, to medical officer, to physician. A lot of different countries are going to do a lot of different things. Plans are in place now in 3 of the 4 countries, or at least developed with the ministry. Mozambique's is a pretty exciting one. We'll see how they go, but I think we'll learn a lot, which gets to Richard's question about we're going to have to learn a lot about the right way to do this, because we don't know for sure the right way to do it, and it might be different, very different from country to country. On the private sector, I think this is one of the things that has been done extraordinarily well in the last couple of years, but where there's enormous room for improvement. We've actually tried to shift the paradigm for public-private partnership and to shift the paradigm for what you want from the private sector. 8 years ago, the approach was generally hat in hand, can you give us $50,000 for a clinic or, you know, contribute to this or that? That's not what we need from the private sector. That's not the role of the private sector. What we need from the private sector is their expertise. And it gets to people and what real development, where you get real development. And one of the biggest impediments is systems, human resource systems, logistics systems, supply chain management systems, communication systems, training, building out. These are not things governments and non-governmental organizations are particularly good at. We have other expertise. These are things companies live or die on. And the way I've kind of described it as don't take an accountant and stick him in a soup kitchen. Take the expertise of the private sector and use that. And actually, that's good for them, too. Because as the president of Citibank described, he said, when I was explaining this to him, he said, what you're basically saying is you want my excess capacity. It doesn't cost them much to do it. It's there anyway. And it's great for their employees because they then feel a sense that their company and what they are doing is actually contributing with their expertise. It feels nice to go to a soup kitchen. It feels better to support an NGO so that they have an accounting structure that can actually radically change many more lives. So that radical shift in what we want from the private sector, I think, is really important, and I hope is carried out to some degree. A lot of room for improvement, a lot of room for expansion, and could go different ways, but I think it's a good template to begin. Which gets me to some degree with the public health evaluation piece and prevention, because this is some of my favorite things we've developed in the last year is on prevention and bringing in the private sector. We are still doing prevention approaches that are 20 years old. We have not progressed in prevention the way we have progressed in care and treatment. And we have particularly bad monitoring and evaluation and of these types of programs. We have something called an HIV-free generation, which is a public-private partnership. We're launching it in Kenya in a couple of weeks, actually, moving rapidly to South Africa and Tanzania. That basically said we are talking about fundamental cultural behavior change, similar to anti-smoking approaches. The private sector has exquisite expertise at messaging and branding and creating things that are cool and interesting for kids. They have the 21st century technology of video games and cell phones and handheld devices that young people will be drawn into. And once you have them drawn in and you use these to teach prevention, care, and treatment messages, particularly prevention, you then have them in a captive way to refer them to male circumcision or to counseling and testing and start building your systems out. And that's where we need to go, which brings in the private sector expertise for what they're good at, but also really takes a generational approach to prevention. And this behavior change is considerably harder than smoking. This is a core part of human behavior that we're trying to modify and create more responsibility in. But we need a generational long-term approach. The reason I said it links a little bit to public health evaluations in the private sector is the private sector is far better at real-time evaluation. It's called marketing research, which some of you are aware of. If a company introduces a product, they will tell you in 2 to 3 weeks whether or not behavior changed to go after it. When we introduce a program or a series of programs, maybe in 5 to 7 years we'll have a demographic health survey that tells us behavior change, whether or not it's related to the programs we initiated or not. That's not a good way to do it. And so we need this real-time marketing research to institute programs. We're calling it the kitchen sink approach. Throw everything you can in a geographic area and then evaluate the heck out of it and see what's working and what's not working, and then use that to go from section to section. So also part of this HIV-free generation is Southern African Prevention Initiative that's really going to target that try to carry this out. And then we're supporting a very important component, which is the political leadership, the champions for an HIV-free generation that President Mohai is leading, because they can then provide the political leadership. We think we ought to be branding all prevention under HIV-free generation to really make that our goal and to push as hard as we can and to have the global branding under that similar to anti-smoking. And that's going to take the private sector, and that's going to take a lot of constant evaluation in real time using new modern techniques that allow us to do it. So I'm really excited about this. We also have a new public health evaluation approach for everything, but I think in prevention we're really pushing finally into the 21st century for it. And the opportunities here are extraordinary if we stay with it. It's also very hard. I mean, again, we're changing 20 years of approaches that people are kind of embedded in and trying to say, let's do something that's actually going to learn from what we've learned in other public health areas and also push to the future. So it's a very exciting time, and these are some of the projects that I think are really going to be important in the coming years.
Let's do another round here. We have some folks in front here.
Thank you. Karen Forright from Futures Group International. Just picking up on this last thing of using advertising and behavior change techniques and using the smoking example, I have a slightly different, so this is more of an observation, that what has really helped with youth is price elasticity of demand. And when you raise the prices of tobacco, youth are very affected by it. And that's the whole thing about advertising, the bans on advertising, the World Health Organization framework treaty convention around advertising of tobacco. So knowing that, and knowing that that sex doesn't cost anything right now, how will we, what other tools might we be able to use for prevention?
Thank you. Eric, behind you in the rear.
Ambassador Dybul, I'm Carol Cones with Safe Blood for Africa Foundation. And
can you speak up?
Oh, am I talking? Can you hear me now? Okay. I'm Carol Cones with Safe Blood for Africa Foundation, and we're a TA provider for PEPFAR. But we're a prevention program, but also a treatment, and we have a youth program, which has provided extraordinary results with behavior change, to reference the lady's question up there. I wondered how you see blood safety and related programs evolving in the new administration and as PEPFAR evolves in the next few years.
Hi, Ravi Gaud with Macro International. You had mentioned, Ambassador Dybul, about enlightened self-interest. And one thing I was curious about is if you could flesh that out, because I'm afraid if we have further fallout from the economic crisis, that politicians are going to have to defend that argument to their constituencies. And I'm curious if, A, we have data to show any of that, and if so, what it is.
Hi, Claire Moran from the British Embassy. I really welcome your comments around efficiency and aid effectiveness. And I think we have a real responsibility to make every aid dollar as efficient as possible. One of the things the UK did is that we untied our development assistance. And so countries, in terms of country ownership, they can source from whatever country, firm, wherever they like. And I'd be interested to hear your views on whether that's something the US should consider. I think studies I've seen show that the money you spend would probably reach an additional 30%. Thanks.
James Hill with the Pan American Health Organization. First, I'd like to congratulate you. The opening remarks were general, but the question and answer, you're one of those speakers that excels in the question and answer. I just wanted to share with you, I went to a meeting September 9th at the Council of Foreign Relations in New York. And the point was made that if PEPFAR progresses as it has in the past, that eventually it'll become a huge entitlement program, which could be a two-edged sword, where the U.S. would eventually have to withdraw that support and many people would die as a result. So the argument was made that, well, perhaps we should shift more into a multilateral approach, putting more funding into Global Fund. My question to you would be, given the bipartisan support that has developed on Capitol Hill, if that was done, if PEPFAR was cut back and more funding was put into Global Fund, do you think that we would have the same bipartisan support that we've enjoyed so far with the PEPFAR program?
On the first point on behavior change, I think you're right. The advertising alone isn't going to change behavior. We know that. And we actually know that awareness doesn't lead to behavior change. But we have not gotten into the 21st century yet. And I mean, I'm 45 years old. I don't understand the vast majority of ways young people are accessing information right now. I don't know what Twitter is. I mean, I've heard of them, but I have no idea. But that's where they're getting, and that's what they think is cool and where they'll come to. So I don't know that we're going to change behavior, but it's a component to get people into sites and areas that we can then target the kind of peer education and link them to other services, counseling and testing so they know their status, male circumcision where appropriate, other opportunities that people believe in should be utilized. And this administration may have different views than the last administration on some of those, but that doesn't matter. What matters is that you get people into an environment where you then have access to them for services. We don't have access to the vast majority of people right now. And what we tend to do in most places, have a really good in-school program or a really good out-of-school program or a really good faith-based program or really good mass media. but not geographic coverage of all of it in the same place. And the way we see the advertising and branding is to get it into a sphere where you can then begin to access people, because right now we're not accessing people. We're not expecting mass media to change behavior. We want to use it as a tool so that the other tools are more effective. So I think you're absolutely right on that. On Safe Blood and its role for the next administration, I think that's up to the next administration. But I do think, especially in this environment, need to recognize where the infections are being transmitted and dedicate the resources there where we have them available. And the fact of the matter is that blood is not where most transmissions are occurring in sub-Saharan Africa. And so it's appropriate to utilize resources, and I think there's been a lot of success going from, and your organization has done very good work. You know, we've gone from about 45% clean blood in the focus countries to about 75% in 4 years. That's a huge gain. One of the wonderful things about malaria programs is demand for blood is dropping considerably because so many of the kids don't get malaria anymore, so don't need the blood. So we hope that it will also contribute to it. But I do think we're going to have to make sure that our resources are following the epidemic. But blood certainly has a role. But again, how that fits in is up to the new administration to determine. On enlightened self-interest, I think there are, and the data, I think there are data and there's messaging. First of all, we have to shift the messaging and really talk about it in a different way. Someone made the point that, I think it was Steve, that the data show we're looking inward. Well, you know, after World War II, the data looked exactly the same. Yet people were able to message and demonstrate and argue for the Marshall Plan and that huge commitment of resources with enlightened self-interest as well as humanitarian concern. So we need to learn from that. It's not the same by any stretch of the imagination, and it's a harder sell. It was much easier to see how Europe could come back than some of the places we do development. But I think we need to learn from those examples. But there are data. No two democracies in the history of the world have ever gone to war against each other. That's a pretty shocking thing when you think about it. If you look at the graphs for economic growth and health, in developing countries, they're superimposable. They go together, and they're linked in ways. 8 of 10 of the countries with the highest approval rating of the United States are in Africa, and when you go there, they'll tell you a lot about why that is, because we're engaged in development. There are data out there. We need better data, but there are data that you can use to put together a cohesive picture where on multiple levels there is enlightened self-interest here. But to be honest, I think we can start with what's happened over the last 3 months. If the last 3 months have taught us nothing, it's that we have a global economy and a global community. And the future markets and the growth of the United States is intimately linked, and our financial and political security is intimately linked with the world. You begin from there. And then you can make the rest of the arguments and use the data and collect more data. We definitely need more data on it. On untying resources and 30% more, that's actually rather extraordinary. Someone actually did the data. I used to just project 20 to 40% if we did better, but wound up right in the middle. This actually gets back to what I was talking about before. We actually have to allow transfer of responsibility and action to local programs and letting them implement programs, and there you get massive efficiencies. 30% is a nice efficiency number. I actually hadn't heard those data before, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's higher actually in some categories of services. But that requires political will and shift, and it requires everyone in this room to buy into that. And it's not always so easy as we saw with just trying to do 25% of our food support from local purchase. So we have to shift as a community, too, and have that long-term vision for how we be more efficient. This will be something that a new administration and Congress will have to struggle with, but it's going to begin with people in this room because they're going to have a difficult time pushing it if everyone in this room fights against it. So we need a real shift in the way we think as well. On entitlements, you know, that word's taken on such a negative character. What we're doing is not negative. These are not entitlements. These are support for people for long term, to give people their life and their productivity, give parents the opportunity to raise their children so the children don't die. It's keeping healthcare workers alive. I mean, 38% of the loss of healthcare workers right now in Zambia are due to HIV/AIDS. Swaziland loses 4% of their healthcare of their nurses a year because of HIV/AIDS. What we're doing is giving the healthcare workers back into the system. We're keeping factory workers alive so that they can produce. We're keeping the term entitlement is so charged these days. I think we should talk more about the positive aspects of what these programs do than the negative aspects, even though that's not what you intended. I just think words matter, and we need to shift away from that. There is strong support in Congress for the Global Fund. There's strong support in this administration, and I suspect in a new administration for the Global Fund. It really is about the amount on an annual basis and how you transition. And it gets back to those core principles. If you can demonstrate country ownership, good governance, and results-based, and efficiency within that, then I don't personally see a problem. But that's not for me to decide. That's for a new administration and a new Congress. It also means that people in this room have to be comfortable with that shift, too. Not only do we have to be comfortable with a shift towards local organizations, we have to be comfortable with a shift to multilateral. That also requires the multilateral organizations to be structured in such a way and to produce results and to function well. And that's why this last board meeting of the Global Fund was so encouraging, because it really performed in a remarkable way and really demonstrated its maturity and evolution. We can all improve. The Global Fund can improve. We can improve. But I don't worry so much about support based on multilateral or bilateral as long as we demonstrate those key principles.
Okay, we're going to take one more round quickly. We have a woman in the blue scarf. Come up to Tony. Back behind you there.
Sorry. Thank you. Hi, I'm Jessica Hulse, and I'm with Chevron. And you had mentioned integrating programs more with what the country needs as opposed to looking at it as an HIV program, a nutrition program, and so on. And I wonder if you have any comment on the Doctors Without Borders proposal to do a similar integration in terms of working nutrition programs in and having them originate out of the ministries of health in certain countries and working with the various aid organizations that are providing the support there.
Just a trademark, I want to first commend you for how great a job you've done and how you are so able to talk to so many different audiences. I've seen you speak at various venues, and you really resonate in so many different venues. Congratulations. Could you just reflect back a little bit and just discuss a little bit about the importance and power of leadership at the national level?
Will the focus continue to be on abstinence only, or will it provide the comprehensive range of prevention services for this youth?
Thank you. Why don't we close on that?
The last question kind of closes where we started 5 years ago, and I'd hope we were no longer there. So I'm going to start there so we don't end with that. We have never had an abstinence-only policy. We have never supported abstinence-only. We will never support abstinence-only, and I seriously doubt the next administration will, because that's not what works. President Bush has never spoken about prevention without saying abstain, be faithful, and correct and consistent condom use. We have now supplied more than 2 billion condoms. Resources for condom production, condoms and other prevention have increased sixfold since the emergency plan began. So I hope we can get past all of that. I think the legislation did. It's never been the policy of this administration. It should never be the policy of any administration, because you need a comprehensive approach that prevention is chronic care management. It's as much of an entitlement in some ways as treatment, because you have to start with very young people and stay with them till they're beyond risk, which for many people is decades and decades into their life. And that means you have different messages and approaches as people change, and you've got to keep them real and fresh, which I think is where the private sector... We're not asking the private sector to provide us with the basis of the message. We're asking them to brand it and message it. We can provide that, the structure. One of the exciting parts about the HIV-free generation is we're really trying to look at the complexities of culture and especially gender issues. And so, for example, one thing we've learned over the last couple of years is in internet cafes, which is a great opportunity to reach youth, girls won't come if they don't have a separate time or a separate day because they're not comfortable in the environment with the boys. So we're separating that out. In video games that are being developed, we're looking at both women and girl-friendly and male-friendly approaches. Also to link to other services that are unique to some to women. And then also a key part of this, which in many ways is the most exciting part, is to think about cultural issues around gender and transgenerational sex and how girls respect themselves and how boys respect the girls. And that's all built into this. And that's the thing that's always bothered me about the ABC discussion. What happens beneath those letters is an incredibly complex and rich approach. When we report on AMB, there's an enormous amount of gender equality work going on there, of teaching young people to respect themselves and respect others. That's the message. But if you do that, then you have different activities, including young boys not preying on young girls, which is where we've seen much of the success, which is also awfully empowering for women. But also the opportunities for microfinance and more of that, real jobs. So a part of this program and where the private sector is important is not only for messaging, but working with them. What we do now to get kids off the street, what we do now for job training is train kids for phantom jobs. You know, we train them in computers and hope that somehow that training will lead to a job. What we're going to do is partner with the private sector locally to say, what jobs do you actually have and what do you want? And then we'll train the young people for those jobs and already have a commitment from the companies to get those to put the young people into the jobs. Now, we really need to evaluate what that does in terms of HIV. It could be neutral, it could increase infection, or it could decrease infection. And we need to know that. That would change what we finance in terms of the activity, but if it increases infection, for example, it also tells us we need to redouble our efforts because growth in economies and women's empowerment is a key core area of development. That just means we need to redouble our prevention efforts along that way. If it reduces infection, then we ought to be doing huge amounts of it. If it's neutral, then we'll need to work the process out. But I think we need to move past these kind of labels and think about what you actually do related to the programs. I think there's been a lot of progress there. I just did 3 interviews in Europe. They all started with, why has PEPFAR been such a huge success? And I only got one question on abstinence. That's not where we were 3 years ago. So I think there's been tremendous progress here, but we still have some progress to be made. On the Médecins Sans Frontières, I don't know that proposal, but to be honest, it's not unique. There are many organizations that are integrating food and nutrition programs with HIV programs in many different ways and innovative ways. Last year, with a congressional appropriation directive, but also we were already pretty close to it, we found out when we looked at it, we have $100 million that goes into food support activity. That's likely to increase in this year. I don't remember what the mark and the bills were in the House and Senate this year. But there is opportunity here, and we've been trying to push awfully hard for a better integration across the different accounts in our own development infrastructure to make sure that health in general, not just HIV/AIDS and food programs, are linked better together. Got a lot of room for progress. And this really gets back to the bureaucratic walls. I mean, we have partners that provide both health services and food services that go through completely different mechanisms that don't talk to each other. Sometimes people in their own organizations don't know what the other one's doing. That's not real efficient. So we've got a lot of opportunity. I don't know that proposal, but there are many other organizations doing similar work. On leadership at the national level, you didn't say if you meant here or there. So that's the nice thing about questions. I can answer whichever way I want. There is no question about the role of leadership from the top down to the grassroots level. And it's not just political leadership. It's political, It's in non-governmental organizations, it's in faith-based organizations. It's in tribal, in Africa anyway, in tribal leadership. It gets down to the community. The fact of the matter is that public advertising and public health officials telling people what to do rarely changes anything. It's the grassroots, credible leaders locally that make a difference. You need leadership at every level. But it's hard to get that grassroots leadership if you don't have the national leadership. So it all comes together, and that gets back to people, not government to government, people to people. People care what their employers say. If their employer is promoting healthy HIV prevention, care, and treatment, people might listen to that. Or if local business leaders are talking about it, or tribal leaders. We see this over and over and over again. When you have leadership in countries, you have change. And that's been true in this country. President Bush has been an extraordinary leader on this topic. It's hard to describe, for those who don't know how the government works, how much of a difference his personal interest has made in the function of PEPFAR. We would not have succeeded were he not engaged at a personal level. It is very uncommon for someone at the assistant secretary level to have access to the chief of staff and president of the United States and to have regular contact. I have never actually briefed the president because he comes in and starts asking me questions, and he's usually been asking his staff the questions before I ever show up. That type of personal engagement makes an extraordinary difference. Now, I also think we're at a point where you might not need that anymore, because we need it, when you start something completely new, you need that to move through the bureaucracy. I don't know that we need that anymore, but we certainly have two leaders coming in to the presidency and vice presidency who have been leaders on this topic, not just on HIV. I think many of you in this room know we would not have PEPFAR reauthorization if Vice President-elect Biden didn't push it through the Senate. We got through the House, but he moved it through the Senate, and he took political risks and moved it in a way that was bipartisan and respectful, and then Senator Obama was a co-sponsor. So we had tremendous leadership. We can look forward to tremendous leadership. And again, I would just say we have the leaders in the administration and Congress. We should advocate. We should make our views known. But I think, as with this time round, we have people we can trust and believe in. And so we ought to give them a little flexibility, because these are tough things coming up. And they'll make the decisions that are good for the American people. So we've had the leadership. We're going to have the leadership. And it's been critically important and will continue to be critically important.
Mark, that's a wonderful point at which to conclude here. This has been a very rich discussion. I thank you all for being here. Please join me in thanking Mark.